Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Practice Groups, was recorded on Tuesday, October 31st, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call.
Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Groups teleforum conference call, as today we discuss the new best-selling book, Scalia Speaks, Reflections on the Law, Faith, and Life Well Lived. This is Dean Reuter. I'm Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. We're very pleased to be discussing this new book. I mentioned it is a bestseller. That is per the New York Times bestseller list. It is available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. Again, there's a link to the Amazon page in the notice you got, but just in case you don't have that handy, the title of the book, once again, Scalia Speaks, Reflections on the Law, Faith, and Life Well Lived. It is getting rave reviews from the left and the right, and we might hear more about those reviews from our speakers. Before we begin, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to get opening remarks from each of our co-editors of about 10 minutes, and then maybe some back and forth. Maybe I'll have a question or two, but ultimately we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please have those in mind. We're going to hear first from Edward Whalen. He's co-editor of Scalia Speaks, and he's also the president of the Ethics and Public and Policy, the Ethics and Public Policy Center. And he'll be followed in opening remarks by Christopher Scalia. He's co-editor of Scalia Speaks and son of the late Justice Scalia. With that, Ed Whalen, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. It's really been my great pleasure over recent months to co-edit this wonderful collection of speeches by Justice Scalia, to dive into the treasure trove of speeches that, frankly, Chris and I were largely unaware of. Very few of the speeches in the book have ever been published before. And I have to say, as someone who deeply admired the justice and had the privilege of clerking for him years ago, he very much comes alive when I read the speeches. I hear his voice. I see his gestures. I know when he laughs. You just hear his distinctive voice in every speech. The book contains brilliant explorations of the Constitution, originalism, and the role of judges, has deep reflections on citizenship, religion, and political philosophy, inspiring talks on life, faith, and courage. There are some wonderful, stirring portraits of American heroes like Washington and Lincoln, and even some very touching eulogies of friends. There's even a speech that begins, "I have been asked many, many times, to what do I attribute my well-known athletic prowess?" Justice Scalia then gives a charming account of the games and sports he played in his youth in Queens in the 1940s and early 50s. Games like stoop ball, stick ball, street hockey, and something called Ringolivio. The book is filled not only with Justice Scalia's wisdom, but with his wit. Here's one of many passages that I think readers will enjoy. This is from a speech to Irish Americans about the Irish from the Italian point of view. So the Italian view of the Irish. And the one thing you need to have as background for this excerpt I'm going to read is that Justice Scalia's wife of more than 50 years was born Maureen McCarthy. "The first appealing quality about the Irish, as seen by us subtle Italians, is their bluntness. There's very little beating about the bush with them. You always know where you stand. My wife Maureen has this endearing quality to a preeminent degree. An example that occurs to me is not really Maureen's own line, but a cartoon obviously inspired by an Irishman, which she left on the breakfast table shortly after I'd been confirmed to the Supreme Court. It shows a stern-looking paunchy fellow sitting at the breakfast table across from his wife, reading the paper, and the wife in the cartoon is saying, 'While you are a conservative jurist who believes in judicial restraint, you are also a louse.'" There's a beautiful foreword in the book by Justice Scalia's dear longtime friend, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The foreword closes with this sentence. If our friendship encourages others to appreciate that some very good people have ideas with which we disagree, and that despite differences, people of goodwill can pull together for the well-being of the institutions we serve and our country, I will be overjoyed, as I'm confident Justice Scalia would be. As Dean mentioned, the book has received great reviews across the ideological spectrum. One of my favorites went online just yesterday. It's going to appear in the New York Times book review this coming Sunday. It's by Alan Dershowitz. Professor Dershowitz, in this review, discusses his longtime enjoyment of arguing with Justice Scalia, and the review is, in many ways, continues that argument. But there are also some beautiful passages, and he praises the book as a marvelous collection of Justice Scalia speeches that he says brought Nino back to life for me. So he's, you know, continues to argue with him, and then at the very end, where's this great passage? Here it is. He was more than an influential justice. He was a great man who lived life to the fullest as a devout Catholic, a proud Italian-American, a devoted family man, a loyal friend, and a person of humor and culture who fondly remembered his roots in Queens and New Jersey. And as Alan Dershowitz explains, Scalia Speaks will give you this insight into Antonin Scalia in full, not just the justice. That said, most of you on this call are probably lawyers, so I do want to emphasize also that you'll really enjoy the legal speeches here, speeches that on topics that radiate out from originalism, whether on legislative history, the vocation of a judge, how to interpret the Constitution, the freedom of speech, so many others. There are, I don't know, a dozen or so speeches on legal topics. But our goal here has really been to present the justices' speeches in a way that not only lawyers but the general public will appreciate. So I think this is a book that you and your family members will really enjoy. I mentioned Justice Ginsburg's foreword. The book also contains a roast by Justice Scalia of then Judge Ginsburg on her 10th anniversary on the D.C. Circuit, and it's really a lots of good humor and just really demonstrates his friendship with her right there. So I've been blogging a bit about the book on Bench Memos. I invite you to follow it there. I've been calling attention to these reviews. Again, I'm confident, if you think you might enjoy it, I'm confident that you will love this book and hope that you see fit to recommend it to others. So with that, I'm eager to get your questions and talk about other aspects of this once Chris has had a chance to talk. So let me just hand it over to Chris right now.
Hi, everyone. I want to second Ed's thanks to Dean for organizing this and to all of you for participating. I really appreciate the time you're taking out of your day. So I am Chris Scalia. I am Antonin Maureen's eighth child. They used to just call me number eight. That's not totally true. But as Ed said, it was just a great honor to work on this book. And as he said, reading these speeches was like hearing his voice again, and Dershowitz said as much in his review. You can really hear his voice strongly, and unlike that's true of his dissent as well, obviously. But I think one of the great things about this collection and his speeches in general is that he can be more personal in writing, in delivering speeches. He was more of a performance than just writing an opinion, and I think that personality and that range is what makes this collection so much fun. I want to take a few minutes to just describe and read passages from some of my favorite speeches. One of them is called Writing Well. He delivered this one to a group of lawyers an organization called Scribes, which is a group of lawyers that tries to improve the status of writing in the legal profession. And he won a Lifetime Achievement Award from that organization. So he was given the award, and he did something pretty surprising and pretty funny when he accepted the award. He got up there, and one of the first things he did is he said this. He said, "You got to get a new name for this award. Lifetime Achievement Awards are best known at the annual Oscar ceremonies, where they are given to some old-time actor who never won an Oscar but should have, just for sheer persistence and endurance. The awardee usually crosses the stage on a cane. I assume that your award has none of these connotations, and therefore accept it with great pride. But get a new name." A great way to open the speech, I think, a surprising way to open the speech. But I love this speech also because you get insights into how hard he worked at his own writing. He describes what he calls the time and sweat that's necessary to write well and that he put into his writing. And he tells a story about a freshman composition professor he had at Georgetown named Professor Orr, who he says in the speech was a damned hard grader, and he gave a writing assignment every weekend. I was not accustomed to getting the B minuses that I received on my first few assignments, and as a consequence, every weekend of my first semester, I devoted many nervous hours to writing and rewriting. I am grateful to this day. The collection is full of little personal anecdotes like that that give you insights into his childhood, his education, and how he became what he was. And just as anyone who writes and is interested in writing, I think will appreciate and enjoy that speech. Another one of my favorites, and one I didn't know, it really kind of surprised me that he delivered it, was one he delivered at the Juilliard School in New York City. He was part of a symposium on to celebrate the school's 100th anniversary, and he was on a panel that included the opera singer Renee Fleming, David McCullough, who's the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, and Stephen Sondheim, the Tony Award-winning composer. So it was a really unlikely panel for him to be on, and he acknowledges that at the beginning of the speech. He says, "I am happy to be here this afternoon, and to tell you the truth, somewhat surprised to be here this afternoon. Today's program reads like some sort of IQ test. Which of the following is out of place? Diva, author, composer, lawyer." And he goes on to make fun of himself and lawyers in general for a little bit before transitioning into a point that law is actually important to the arts because it makes the performance of the arts possible. And then from there it becomes a discussion of freedom of speech and First Amendment rights. And he does something in that talk that he liked to do in his speeches, which was to challenge his audience. He establishes early in the speech that, like the other people there, he is a lover of the arts, and particularly, as many of people there would have already known, he loved opera. But he goes on to say that doesn't mean that all of the arts he enjoys and they enjoy are protected by the First Amendment. And he goes on to explain that, in fact, many arts are not protected by the First Amendment, and from an originalist perspective explains why that is and what the freedom of speech meant at the time of the Constitution's ratification. It's a really interesting speech and that again, shows a lot of his personality, a lot of his warmth and humor, but also challenges the audience. He does something similar in Natural Law, which is a speech he delivered. One of the last speeches he delivered, I think the latest one we have in the collection, he delivered it just a couple of months before, well, really just a few weeks before his death. And he delivered it at the Dominican House of Studies in D.C., and it was about St. Thomas Aquinas, who had been a Dominican. So he's delivering this speech to an audience that would be very receptive to him, a group of fellow Catholics. They have obviously a lot in common. And my father had great respect for Dominicans, but he took this opportunity to challenge Thomas Aquinas's attitudes towards law, and at one point compares Aquinas to Earl Warren, which was it was a laughing matter, but a very funny joke, but a surprising way for my father to describe Aquinas. And I've talked to people who were at that speech, and they still say, I can't believe he went there. It was pretty surprising to everybody at the time. But again, this was how he approached the speeches. He didn't tell people. He made a point of not telling people what they wanted to hear, because, as he said, if they wanted to hear it, they probably already believed it, so there was no point in telling them. So he saw these speeches as opportunities to educate and challenge. I want to talk about one more speech very quickly. I mentioned some of the personal insights these speeches include, and one of them, Ed mentioned the final section, which is about heroes and friends, and this includes a number of eulogies and memorials he delivered about deceased friends and colleagues. And one of them is the dean of the UVA Law School, Emerson Spies, who passed away in 1990. And that includes just writing that you won't find in, I think, any of my father's opinions. It's almost poetic language. He never really took or had the opportunity to write like this in his opinions. I'd like to just quickly read a particularly beautiful passage in which my father describes his days in Charlottesville this would have been in the 70s with Emerson Spies. He wrote, "There, those who are fortunate enough to have experienced it will recall another aspect of Emerson's life, Emerson the azalea grower. I suppose there are more impressive displays of azaleas somewhere, perhaps in the Arboretum in Washington. But I have never enjoyed anything as much as the spring party Emerson used to throw for the faculty, when we would stroll through several acres of resplendent azaleas, gin and tonics in hand, taking only slightly more pleasure in the flowers than we did in Emerson's childlike delight at having produced them." Well, that's all I had to say, or all I wanted to read from the speeches. So I guess at this point we can open it up.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. This is once again Dean Reuter. Let's open the floor to questions right away. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either or both of our guests, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button, and we'll get to your question momentarily. I want to start off myself, if I could, just by congratulating both of you for what you've put together here. The book, again, the title, Scolia Speaks, it's available on Amazon.com. The link to that page is in the flyer for today. If you Google Scolia Speaks, it'll take you right to the page. I wanted to mention before we turn to the audience that the Federal Society will be hosting a book signing and a closing panel at the convention, the Federal Society of National Lawyers Convention, on November 18th at the Mayflower Hotel. So that's an opportunity to meet these two gentlemen and have your copy of the book signed by them. So if you buy a copy, bring it along, and there'll be a book signing after the closing panel at the convention. So don't miss that opportunity. Today we have the opportunity for you to ask questions. Push the star button and then the pound button if you'd like to join the queue for questions. We begin with one question, then our lines are going to be wide open. Let's take our first call.
Hi, I just wanted to ask if you knew who your father's favorite justice was.
That sounds like
Chris, go ahead, and then I'll offer some thoughts on that.
Well, I can, because I'm trying to plug the book here, I can say that the book includes a wonderful speech about Taft. The book includes speeches my father delivered about George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, two guys, you know, on the list of anybody's great Americans, and then Taft. And my father loved Taft as a Chief Justice, because I think he felt a kinship with him as an originalist, and appreciated also Taft's approach to the law and reverence for the law. I don't know if that made him his favorite, but I found that speech to be particularly surprising and interesting, because it does seem to come from left field. But I think Ed would probably know better my father's all-time justice rankings.
Ed Whalen.
Sure. Well, yeah, I think Chris is right that there was a great respect for Taft. And you see in Justice Scalia's Morrison versus Olson dissent, a lot of drawing on Taft's separation of powers wisdom. Look, Chief Justice Marshall was another justice that Justice Scalia respected quite a bit. He loved Justice Jackson's writing. I think he thought that Justice Jackson was among the best writers ever on the court. Obviously, he was blessed to have as a colleague for most of his time on the court, Clarence Thomas, for whom he had such great fondness and respect. Those are the ones that come to mind, though I never had a conversation with him asking him to rank the justices. And I think what you see is that he had an impressive capacity to appreciate the good in people and in jurists, while also having in mind the flaws. So he was able to form friendships with people where he admired their good qualities, while recognizing, of course, that in many respects they had fundamental differences.
Once again, if you have a question, our lines are wide open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Happy to take your questions. We do have, looks like now, two questions. So let's continue on with the caller questions. I will hold my own questions in deference to the callers. Go right ahead, caller.
Hi. So first, I just want to say thank you both to Ed and Chris for putting the book together. I think it's a great blessing to all of us to have this. And just wanted to say also that I'm a big fan of both of you and try to follow your writing and read as much as I can of it. And Chris,
is this your brother?
That's right.
No,
actually, your brothers would be saying that. I'm sorry. Thank you very much.
Chris, my question is for you. I know how much you care about writing, and I'm just curious how your father influenced you in that regard, and if you could just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. First of all, thank you for those very kind words. I appreciate it. Yeah, my father was a great influence on my writing, and I have the memory of one night I was working on my I was in college. I must have been working on my senior thesis, and my dad came in, and I was working on it at the kitchen table. He came in. I was home for spring break or something, and he started reading through a page, and he didn't have a red pen or anything like that. It was just kind of an impromptu marking, and he just pointed out instances where I was just being imprecise. And I think that was that's a lesson I took to heart most from his writing, is just being precise, being clear and direct. Obviously, he's not the only great writer who approach writing that way, but when I saw him actually at work with that approach, it was kind of a good demonstration of what the time and sweat he writes about in the speech I mentioned earlier actually looked like, winnowing down drafts from, you know, 3 pages to 2 pages or something like that, and just being really careful with the specific words you're choosing.
Great. Well, thank you very much again. I really appreciate what you guys have done and what you're continuing to do to publicize the book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, then our lines are open. Let's take another call.
Hey, Chris, this is John Santarelli, longtime fan of your dad's. Do you have any insight into his decision to leave the faculty at the University of Virginia Law School and come up here to Washington to work for the Nixon administration?
Hi, John. I don't.
It's Don.
Oh, sorry, Don. No. Well, thank you, Don. But still, my answer is no. this was before those were before my time. So, you know, I probably talked about. I certainly talked to him about how much he liked teaching and things like that, but I never really talked to him about why he made the move or anything like that. So I'm afraid I can't offer insight into that particular decision. I do know that he really enjoyed teaching, and that I know that he kind of missed it after he left. And I see kind of the I see these speeches as sort of an opportunity for him to continue that teaching in a different sort of way. But no, I don't know the specifics of his reasoning in leaving UVA. Ed, is that something you know anything about, Ed?
Yeah, I think I may have read something about this, actually, in Joan Biskupic's biography. I have in mind that that as he developed his expertise in administrative law and being not that far away from D.C. and Charlottesville, he was coming up here a fair amount to consult and work. And not surprisingly, he impressed the people and opportunities developed and he decided to give it a go. So, he loved teaching, but I think I could also see how the isolation of it wouldn't really be the attraction. I think he wanted to have an impact in the world. So I'm guessing that was part of the answer.
I can fill you in a tiny bit on that, and that is that I was a newly appointed member of the University Board of Visitors, and I was meeting Nino, as we called him then, as part of a faculty reception to the new board members. And we got into an immediate conversation because I was in the Justice Department at the time, and I engaged dramatically in recruiting him to come up and join the new administration and worked diligently to find a spot for him, which was not available in the Justice Department at the time. We wanted to put him in the Office of Legal Counsel, but it was not empty at the time. A guy named Bill Rehnquist was occupying it. And so we found the job of chief counsel, to the Office of Telecommunications Policy.
Right. Well, wonderful. Well, thank you. That's a critical step in so much that ensued. So that's wonderful to hear.
Yeah, thanks, Don. That's great.
There's an Ed Whalen who authored a book long ago called To Catch a Falling Flag. Any relative?
No relation at all. So but I'll look for it.
It was a critique of the Nixon administration after its first year in failing to, in the author's opinion, to carry on the campaign pledges. Anyway,
uh-huh.
Enough. I'm occupying other people's time.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
Once again, our lines are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button. Now is the time. While we're waiting to see who else might ring in, I'll ask a question. The book, Scalia Speaks. Can you tell us a little bit about – well, first of all, I'm not sure it's clear to the audience, but this is not merely a collection of speeches. You've collected the speeches and printed them. I think the previous caller had it right. This is a great service. A lot of these speeches, as you mentioned in your opening, Ed, have never been published before. So it's great to have them all in one volume. But you also provide context, I think, critically for each of these pieces. So you give some background and orient the reader as to what they're about to read, which I think is enormously helpful. But my question really is about the process, one, in deciding to do this. How you decided to do that, and how you came together to do it together, and then secondly, how you went about, selecting which pieces to highlight, how to group them, which of you was going to write the sort of context or introduction for each. Just tell us about that, if you could.
Sure. Well, let me take a stab, and I should mention that Chris has a beautiful introduction to the book right after Justice Ginsburg's foreword. It not only provides an overview of the book, but also just his own insights into his father's life and his father's loves. Chris and I were invited by Mrs. Scalia to co-edit this book, I think back in the late winter or early spring, not that long ago. And I, of course, was honored by the invitation, but had no idea what we would, what these speeches would be. I thought there would be maybe a half dozen speeches that the justice gave year in, year out, and would put together a thin volume, and it'd be fun, but that would be it. So I was just amazed. I think Chris was too when we received these piles of speeches and paper speeches, and then these electronic files. And just had, I spent a couple of weeks just pouring through these. Again, for me, it was a real wonderful discovery of speeches I had no idea existed on all these many topics. And so what we needed to do was, sort through them, figure out what to keep, what not to. I will say, as a lawyer familiar with some of his great legal speeches, I really almost felt compelled to keep speeches like originalism, the lesser evil, and rule of law, law of rules in. Those two speeches ended up not making the cut, in part because there's so many other good ones, and we wanted to have speeches that were really accessible to and enjoyable by all. So in the end, the challenge became which speeches to exclude in order to keep the volume at a manageable size. And with the assistance of our editor at the I think we ended up with a really good organization that unfolds the justice's views in a very coherent, appealing way. Chris, you want to add some thoughts there?
Yeah, just to build on what Ed was saying, when we first started it, we read about 200 of his speeches, and again, we were surprised as Ed said, just how varied they were and how high the quality was consistently. And like Ed, there were some speeches I assumed we would include. Another one was, he mentioned a couple, but there was one that was about capital punishment and Catholicism. And rereading it, just realized that it wasn't right for the audience we were going for. It was, as Ed and our editor at Crown put it, was just a little too in the weeds for a general readership. So we didn't include that one. And there was another one basically he gave a stump speech through the 90s and early 2000s about originalism. And I thought for sure we would include that. But as it turned out, he never wrote that speech down. Instead, he worked from what he called the outline, which was basically just a very rough sketch, just a couple of dozen words, a series of prompts that would get him that he would speak from, pretty close to indecipherable to anybody but him. And so he never actually wrote the speech down. We couldn't include it. I think we toyed with, or I toyed, I don't think Ed ever seriously considered transcribing a version of the speech we if we were able to find one online, but instead we just decided to leave that alone and not include it. And instead, there's a version of the speech, kind of a more refined and polished version that he delivered. I think he delivered that in Australia that we ended up including. But there were some difficult choices of what to exclude. But I think it, obviously that we're really happy with what we did end up including.
Dean mentioned the headnotes. These are very brief, maybe just a few sentences at the beginning of each speech. We're trying to let the justice do the talking and keep our own role minimal. But one of the things that was a real challenge was to figure out when and where the speeches were given, because in almost every case, you couldn't really tell from the face of it when and where it was given. There would be some internal clues. You could cross-reference different indices. But it took a great deal of work to nail down, yes, this speech was given in this place. But what I really had fun doing was calling people once I figured out, oh, this was a speech given to the Marine Corps Air Base at Cherry Point, North Carolina. I managed to do a Google search, figure out who the chaplain was who invited him down there, and had a great talk with him. And you just discover how fresh people's memories were of his talks. And it was really, a lot of fun to people would send photos and all sorts of other things that they had in connection with the speeches. He twice spoke to the National Wild Turkey Federation convention in Nashville. So we have a speech on turkey hunting in the collection as well. There's a big challenge really to nail down with respect to all these speeches, just when and where they were delivered.
Once again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your phone. The lines are wide open. We've got just one question pending now, so let's take another call. But before I go to this next caller, let me ask an institutionally selfish question, and that's whether is it your impression he spoke more to the Federalist Society than to any other institution, or do you have a sense of that?
Well, I think so, but I think his standard speech to the Federalist Society would have been this stock speech from the half-page outline. So we do not have any sort of comprehensive record of the speeches he gave. And my guess is that, looking through his papers, we might be able to piece together speeches, at least for a couple decades worth, that involved travel. But, of course, he gave a lot of speeches in the D.C. area, including lots of speeches at the court to school groups or, the foreign judges, whoever would come in. But obviously, he loved the Federalist Society and was a great force from the beginning. I'm trying to recall, it's odd, Dean. I'm not sure that there's a single speech in the collection that was specifically traced to a Federalist Society event. But again, we know he spoke at a lot of them.
Yeah. Once again, if you have a question, star button, then the pound button. We've got two questions pending, about 25 minutes left. Let's carry on.
Hey, I'm Mike Doherty here in Atlanta. I'm not a lawyer, and I belong to Federal Society now for 5 years. And one of the best things about it was I actually had the luck to spend some time with Justice Scalia in Park City, Utah, and I did not pass up the opportunity. And I found him extremely grounded and interesting and really transparent, as long as you had an intelligent question. And I want to make sure I did. So I wanted to ask you, my concerns when he passed away was if he really drove himself into the ground, because he was so larger than life and passionate. He seemed to really enjoy being out in public and really educating people. And I always, the point, I never knew if he took care of himself, because he really lit up with all this stuff. So what really drove him on that personal level, and what things kind of got under his skin, other than maybe a lousy lawyer and a bad argument?
I'll try this one first, Ed. I think what drove him was that basically he was concerned that the living Constitution was winning, and he needed to change that, or he needed to do his part, and dissents weren't enough. He needed to speak to as many people as possible, and he needed to address law students directly, not just in his dissents or in his majority opinions. I mentioned earlier his love of teaching. I think these speeches, again, were opportunities for him to teach more about originalism as much as he could. Obviously, again, that's not the only thing he spoke about, but I think that was a primary force and why he spoke about the law as much as he did. As far as what got under his skin, I think you named the two biggies: weak arguments and one biggie: weak arguments, and I would add imprecise arguments or imprecise writing. That was true at home too. I mean, during dinner table discussion, if one of us tried to get away with, he wouldn't let us get away with a weak argument or a sloppy statement. And, I think that was one thing that certainly carried over into his judicial approach as well.
Well, I have to say, when he was upset in his writing, I laughed. When I was flying to Salt Lake City, I was sitting next to someone. They asked me if I was reading comedy, and I said, no, I'm reading Scalia. And because when he was upset, it was absolutely masterful, terrifyingly masterful, but hilarious at the same time. And I think that's what I'm going to miss most.
Yeah,
I tell you, you'll find lots of lines to chuckle at in this book, and again, hoping this will be part of his enduring legacy.
Yeah, great.
If I could add just a bit to what Chris was saying, I think you see in the book how deeply American Justice Scalia was, how much he loved this country, how he saw that the Constitution itself, was a miracle of sorts, and we had this legacy that it was our obligation to protect and pass on to future generations. And I think he was deeply concerned in so many ways that we were losing what made this country distinctive, and that he was, felt a professional vocation to do what he could to see if things could be turned around. So, yes, he was very driven. He drove himself hard. I mean, look, it's hard work to write a good speech, and to write one excellent speech after another, as he did, on top of everything else, when he could just have been taking it easy, is really remarkable.
That's very well put, Ed, about what drove him. Very well put.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got some time left, just one question pending. Let's take another call.
This is Paul Cavender. First a comment and then a question. My comment is I bought the book and to put it in my queue of books to read, and yet I couldn't not read some, so I got hooked up and it jumped around, and it was just so good. You know, it started with the Ginsburg forward, and then ended up at the back and read some farewell speeches that he wrote, and then I ended up somewhere over in the middle, so I look forward to picking it up again and actually reading it. But
well, actually, Paul, you are reading it, and thanks for saying that, because it's a book that could be read exactly that way. It's not so much a book that I expect readers to pick up and read from beginning to end. I think people will want to read it entirely, but we have a succinct table of contents precisely so that people can skim it and decide, hey, why don't I read this? And some speeches are very short. The average speech is probably only 7 or 8 pages. So it's the sort of thing where people can bounce around. I guess I'd recommend, as you do it, have a pen in your hand to mark those you've read, so you make sure you get to those you haven't.
Well, I agree. And the farewells at the end give such insight into so many aspects of his personality and what he thought was important, and his wit and his humor, given though in appropriate ways for those circumstances. So I just really commend you for that. Let me ask you if you are aware of a speech that he gave in September of 2013, a speech at the Lanier Theological Library in Houston, and the title of it is Capitalism or Socialism More Conducive to Christian Virtue.
Well,
if you have,
that's in there.
We have that speech in here. I'll find the title it's under. We call it
Left or Right, or Right and Left. It's on page 333.
Yeah, it was actually delivered. The version we have, we traced to a different delivery point. It was to
the Roman Catholic group in Italy.
Yeah, Gregorian University in Rome in May 1996. But I'm pretty sure you'll find that to be the same speech.
He referenced that he, in receiving the assignment, he decided to do a takeoff on something he'd already done. Yeah, I just commend anybody interested in being listening to this call might want to check this out, because it's video, and so he comes across, it's the full profile of him, his intellect, his wonderful painting of pictures with words. His good humor, his spontaneity to get a laugh that clearly wasn't in the speech. I mean, it's just all there. So it's quintessential Scalia from somebody that wasn't a family member viewpoint, and somebody that didn't know him as intimately as some of you guys did. He's a great American. I hope at some point a really fabulous biographer will get hold of his material and write a really, really appropriate and splendid biography, because he's an important character in our country's history.
Well, thank you so much, and please send us a link to the video. We're trying to collect different videos. It's a hard task to do, but I don't think we've seen that one. So if you could send that to one of us, we'd be very grateful.
I will do that. You will love it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, our lines are now wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone while we wait to see. Oh, we do have another question from our audience, so let's check in with yet another audience member.
Hi, I just had another quick question, and it might be something that both Ed and Chris could speak to. And I'm curious whether Justice Scalia had any favorite spiritual reading or any favorite, you know, kind of authors on in the Catholic realm that meant a lot to him and that you could highlight for us.
Sure. Go ahead, Chris.
No, I was just going to say Newman and Chesterton were two of his favorites. That's not an exhaustive list, but I remember him, and it's clear from mentions in the, if you just check the index of the collection, he mentions them quite a few times. But he always found great insight and I think encouragement from both of them.
Those were exactly the two I was going to mention. He also was a great admirer of St. Thomas More. I don't know how much
of
More's writings he read, perhaps the I think the non-legal speech that best captures Justice Scalia's outlook on the world was a speech that is under the title "The Christian as Cretan." He nicknamed the two Thomases. He gave this speech, I don't know, dozens of times over the years, and it basically contrasts the worldview of Thomas Jefferson with that of St. Thomas More.
Yeah, and I can. I'm sorry.
I was just going to add that my father. We haven't really touched on his religious speeches, but the religious section in this book is second only to the legal one, and he really took those religious speeches very, very seriously. They're really important to him, and as Ed was suggesting, they I think reflect his thinking very clearly and powerfully.
Yeah, and I can just tell you from personal experience, I was fortunate enough to hear him give a version of that speech when I was young, and mm-hmm. over the years I've thought a lot about it, and it's meant a lot to me, and I know that I'm sure I'm not alone in taking a lot of encouragement from the justice in terms of how open he was about his faith and just, you know, being such a great role model in the world that he inhabited, you know, actually a lot like Thomas More, to sort of, you know, be in that world but be a person of faith and be as upfront about it as he was. I'm curious if you guys think he would have had any kind of distinctive reaction or take on the whole Amy Barrett thing and her confirmation hearing and some of the comments that some of the senators made. I mean, I don't know if he would have reacted just, you know, I mean, Ed, I know I've seen you write about that, but I'm just curious if you guys have thought, you know, if the justice were here, you know, what would he have, what would he be saying about that? You know, probably not publicly, but what do you think he would have, his
sure,
take on
this
that?
Is, yeah, I think this is a relatively easy one, but though there's a lot to say. First of all, I'll emphasize that, well, I'll mention that Amy Barrett is a former law clerk of the justices, and so he would be delighted to see her, as well as Joan Larson, another former law clerk, going through the hearing process. But, you know, he saw what the Living Constitution did to the judicial confirmation process. You know, he would basically say, look, if you folks on the left want to make judging all about results, then don't complain about what happens. And of course, he would also then recognize that you know, those on the right are going to have to deal with the same process. But I think he would just say, look, this is unfortunately the system you've created. But in terms of the anti-Catholic bigotry that I think was manifested in some of the comments, you know, I think as a Catholic, he would have been very taken aback by that. But I don't know how surprised he would have been. I think he would understand that, you know, how central how Roe is in the left's worldview, and how, you know, threatened it is by judges and potential judges who are perceived viewed rightly as or wrongly as rejecting Roe. So, but I think he'd be very proud of Amy Barrett.
And I would just add that the writing of hers that came under such scrutiny, I think it was pretty clearly misrepresented. From what I can tell, what she was trying to say is that Catholic judges cannot let their religious beliefs, if they conflict with the law, they need to interpret the law. They can't let their religious beliefs overwhelm the law in those situations. And if they're tempted to do that, they need to recuse themselves. I don't think that's what the senator said she was saying, but as I understand it, that's what she was saying. And that's pretty closely along the lines of what my father says in a couple of his speeches here.
Right. Okay, well, thanks again to both of you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let me make another call for questions. If you have a question, we have some time left. Star button, then the pound button on your telephone.
Let me just mention, by the way, I see that Amy Barrett is scheduled to be voted on in 10 minutes on the Senate floor. So hope she'll be confirmed soon. I guess the vote itself can take half an hour or so.
Very good. We don't have any further questions, at least not at this time. We've got about 10 minutes left. Let me ask you, you've both sort of alluded to this. Chris, you said you were surprised by the Juilliard speech, the lineup there, I suppose. And Ed, you said sort of generally you were surprised by the number of speeches, the amount of material here, having anticipated maybe a handful of stock speeches. Were there any other memorable surprises in going through this material? Anything, any little nuggets you picked up? I mean, in my interactions with Justice Scalia, one thing that amazed me is when we were doing this separation of powers course in Colorado. It was on a break, and we were discussing how the course was going. This is a thing he did for Federal Society members. And he said, I just can't get people to ask questions. This was after the first morning. What's wrong? And it was my distinct impression that people were intimidated of him, by him. I said as much, and he seemed amazed at that people would find him to be an intimidating character, sort of larger than life is the way some people have described it here on the phone today. That's one insight I got. Were there any surprises or insights like that you came away with after going through these materials?
Oh, there were a lot of those. And again, I ended up talking with lots of folks who were involved in organizing the speeches or hosting the justice. I remember the president of Wesleyan, I believe Michael Roth is his name, just saying how amazed he was, how generous the justice was with his time, going far beyond their request to just deliver the speech, but spending time with students in classrooms. And I'd hear that, time after time from different people. And you'd also see how he would accept all sorts of invitations from people you think who were, I think, in the end, sort of astonished that their invitation was paid attention to. I mentioned before this remote Air Force base in Marine Corps Air Base in Cherry Point, North Carolina. There was a small Catholic newspaper in Long Island that invited him up for its 30th anniversary, I believe. He gave a beautiful speech there on faith and judging. Now, when I mentioned at one event how surprising it was he would accept all these invitations, one of his sons in the audience piped up, "Well, if there's good hunting and fishing around, that sure helped." And I'm sure that was true. But he really enjoyed getting out and meeting people and wanted to have a very full schedule when he did travel.
So, Chris, the same question to you, really. You grew up with Justice Scalia, not as dad, I suppose, but any other big surprises? I mean, this seems like a tremendous opportunity to be able to go through your father's speeches for us.
Well, first, let me address the your observation that he was surprised that he could be intimidating. I've noticed that this is a family trait. Maybe a curse. It's the Scalia game face. We tend to look much more serious and intense when delivering points than we realize. My brother, Father Paul Scalia, has kind of mentioned the same thing and I've noticed it just in arguments with friends. We always seem a lot more intense than we realize, and I think that probably comes from Dad. But yeah, that certainly rings a bell. He always seemed a lot more intense than maybe he realized. and that may have been what intimidated people. As for surprises, I think I mentioned one in my introduction. You know, a lot of this stuff was familiar to me. I mentioned that freshman composition professor he had, Professor Orr. He used to tell me about that professor and what a profound influence he was on his life. And so I always liked hearing or encountering that anecdote and others that I had heard in the house. It was kind of fun seeing him deliver that or give those anecdotes in other contexts. But then one speech we didn't include included a pretty surprising discovery for me because it was I can't remember the topic. I think it was about libraries or legal research or something like that. And in that, my father described his love of conducting research and how now as a judge, now that he didn't conduct research, he kind of missed it. And so he writes in this speech, the process of looking for that answer, the process of research is a process that stimulates the mind. New analogies occur, new avenues of inquiry come to mind, new insights are afforded. It's not a particularly important passage, but it really kind of hit home for me because I used to be an English professor, and that was one of my favorite things about that line of work was the research. And you know, I wasn't really alive when Dad did that sort of thing, so it never occurred to me to talk to him about it. And it was it was exciting and also a little sad, kind of bittersweet to make that discovery through these speeches that we shared that enjoyment and that attitude towards research.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you both for your efforts in putting this volume together. It's just fantastic. And thank you, of course, for being on our call today. We certainly appreciate your time and your insights into this whole process. Great book about a great man. Again, it's Scalia Speaks. And for those of you in the audience, I want to thank you for joining us as well. A reminder that we're going to be hosting a book signing with these two gentlemen, both of them, as the closing panel at the National Lawyers Convention. That's your opportunity to meet both of them and to have your copy of Scalia Speaks signed. And, of course, as always, check the Federal Society's website for upcoming Teleforum conference calls. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federal Society multimedia, please visit the Federal Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.